through the bill in more detail, so you all have kind of a working knowledge of what we have here before we hear from you. And then we will turn the meeting over to Representative Swales, and we will have introductions of legislators and guests. In fact, I think we'll do that before we go to Mr. Strum. And then we mostly are here to hear from you. So if you haven't yet filled out a green card and you want to, they are in the hallway, and Representative Swales will be calling on you, and you will come up here and say your name and city and then give us your testimony. And we're hoping that everyone will talk for 3 minutes or less so that we can hear from everybody. We will end promptly at 8:30 because we know that some people like to talk to us afterwards, and we don't want to take the whole time of the formal meeting. Sometimes we get really good comments from people after the meeting. And so, before I turn this over to Tim Strom, who is from Nonpartisan House Research, so we always like to have these be bipartisan legislative hearings and nonpartisan information for you, I will just say that I think all of us are getting really good feedback as we go around the state with the new Minnesota Miracle. And we introduced it at the end of session last year and had one hearing at the Capitol, and now we're getting all this feedback so we can reintroduce it next year at the beginning of session, and I'm hoping it will be House File number one and kind of a symbol of how important it is to our state. And we took the good work of two task forces when we developed the bill. One was the governor's task force, and then they got a certain distance, and then PS Minnesota, that most of you are probably familiar with, all the major education groups in the state, took the ideas from the first task force and fleshed them out even more, and then gave some hard-fought and compromised principles to the legislature, and then we worked with our very talented staff and continued working with all the different types of districts to come up with this bill. And the goals of it, that we took from PS Minnesota, are to have a more simplified education formula. Of course, it can never be truly simple, just because then it wouldn't be really fair. But we have simplified it somewhat, taking their recommendation. We want it to be need-based, based on student needs and district needs, fair for everybody, no matter where kids live, so that when they graduate from high school, they get the Chevy model of education funding, so they can all graduate ready for success, whether that's college or university or technical school or going straight to a good job. We take the Chevy model language from PS Minnesota because they figured out how much it would cost to have the bare bones amount that students need in order to pass the test and graduate ready for success. The one thing that I'm particularly excited about is the innovation revenue, because it does include accountability for the new money, and we can hear more about that from Mr. Strom. And also, despite the fact that we have a $2 billion budget deficit, this is a scalable bill. Our people that are brilliant staff people made it so that it could be phased in however much money we put into it. So we don't have to say we have such a deficit that we can't do anything at all. It could be phased in. I call it like the Eiffel Tower. We're working on all the parts so that they fit and are in the right proportions of the different funding formulas, and then we can make it big or small or somewhere in between. And that's what we want to argue about when we get into session, is how big and how to fund this. But we would like to have the pieces kind of agreed upon, and that's why we're having these hearings. And so we appreciate your being here, and we look forward to your testimony. And I'm now going to turn it over to Representative Marcia Swales, who will chair the meeting henceforth. And I just am so pleased with the good attendance of legislators. There's very talented legislators in this district on both sides of me, and Senator Salzman also serves on education. So I'll turn it over to Representative Swales.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. It's so wonderful to have all of you here this evening. We have a lot of wonderful guests who have come from other school districts and other areas from the Twin Cities, and I'd like to recognize these individuals first. If you are superintendents from other school districts, would you please stand? Wonderful. Okay. I know my superintendent, I am fortunate to work in this beautiful school, so I am an English teacher here. My superintendent, Mr. Tom Nelson, can you just wave? And then the superintendent from Stillwater, would you please introduce yourself, sir?
I'm Kit Wiskowski, superintendent of Stillwater.
All right, and then we have the superintendent from West St. Paul School. Would you introduce yourself?
West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Meekin, Jay Howley.
Thank you, Jay Hawkins. Thank you so much. And we have another superintendent over here in the middle of the room.
Steve Jordahl, superintendent of schools in St. Cloud.
You came all the way from St. Cloud. Welcome to Woodbury. We're very thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much. We have school board, elected members of school boards here. Can you stand if you're on the school board? Now, stay standing. They were humble. So I'm going to ask you right here if you'd introduce yourself, please.
I'm Terry Meyer from ISD 199 Burger Heights.
Thank you so much. And you?
Deborah Clark, South St. Paul, and I'm the
Wonderful. Thank you.
Taylor from South St. Paul.
Thank you,
Kate. I'm Stephanie 197 of West St. Paul, Northern
Heights, and Southern. And you?
Just me as well.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to have you here. Now, we have other guests here. Well, are there any city council, any other city officials here, county officials? Well, I'm going to have our House members and senator introduce themselves, but there's one very humble House member sitting in the audience. And would you like to introduce yourself, Representative?
I'm Representative Paul Gardner. I'm sure of you, and I represent Centennial White Bear and Township. I just came to listen today, and then I'm just.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Well, I'd like to see the screen without the
I'm going to pass the mic down. I think we'll start with Representative Gardner.
Good evening. Thank you so much to all of you for coming tonight. I'm Judy Bonner. I represent District 56A, which stretches from the northeast corner of Woodbury, where I just got to just a few minutes ago. We're knocking out to Stillwater, and then it's a part of 10 communities out of Livertown, Lakeland, West Lakeland, State, and the Township. Thank you so much for being here.
I represent Carol McFarland from White Bear. I represent White Bear and Montague School District. And our late arrival is Superintendent Connie Hayes from 915 Montague School District.
Good evening. I'm Representative Jim Dabney. I represent part of South Minneapolis.
And I'm Senator Kathy Saltzman. I represent this district, and I'm pleased to have you all here today. The Senate met, a number of us on our E12 Finance Committee, so I've been talking education all day, so look forward to this meeting very, very much.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Representative Tim Faust from Mora. I represent District 8B, which is all of Kennebec and part of Pine Rest Sandy County.
All right, thank you so much, everyone, and thank you all again for attending, and welcome, Superintendent. We are so glad that you came as well. I'm going to have Tim Strong from House Research. Once again, it's a bipartisan role that he plays in the House, and at this time, I'm going to ask him to move to the lectern to give a presentation for us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Strong. I work for an office called House Research. We're a nonpartisan office that serves all 134 House members. My job is to help members with their questions related to education finance, education facilities, and educational location decisions. What I'd like to do tonight is spend about 5 minutes talking about what happened last session, and then spend about 15 minutes talking about the details of House File 4178. As many of you know, the legislature budgets on a two-year or biannual basis, so that means the odd-numbered year is the big year for making budget decisions. Even-numbered years tend to be bonding years, and small legislative decisions get made in those years as well. Last year, the 2008 session was no exception. The legislature made some relatively modest changes to the school funding formula. As you can see from this slide, those included adding $51 to the formula allowance per pupil on a one-time basis, authorizing a fund transfer districts that have excesses in their capital accounts. This is mainly important for small school districts and doesn't matter much for the larger school districts. Increase the maximum levy authority for lease purposes for those school districts that we state. And two other levy decisions that were implemented. A small levy was created for those school districts that are members of local collaborative time study projects. There was a federal audit that required the funding to be done somewhat differently, and a number of school districts were left with some obligations that they're now able to meet with a one-time levy. And then finally, in the tax bill this last session, there was authority given to school districts to levy for what's referred to as other post-employment benefits. We're real unsure what school districts are going to do on this front. We're expecting probably about 30 school districts to use this levy authority. It will help them pay for the cost that previous boards have agreed to in terms of retiree health benefits. The 2008 legislature also made a few changes that affect funding for fiscal years 2010, that's next school year, and later. And probably the most important of these changes is the way that permanent school fund money is handled. The permanent school fund revenue comes from the mining and logging interest of the state primarily. The proceeds from those activities go into this fund, and the interest on the money can be paid out to school districts. Under the current scenario, before the law was changed, school districts essentially receive an offset to their other general education aid. So that means that the relative amount of the permanent school fund doesn't really matter to school districts since it's just an aid offset. The change that was made this last session will require that money now to go to school districts as additional aid payments. That means two things. One, it means a relatively small amount of additional money is going to schools, but perhaps more importantly, it's going to change the balance, in my view anyway, between the arguments over how the permanent school fund lands are managed. I'm expecting that this is to be somewhat controversial in the next couple of years, but in the short term anyway, the result means that there's going to be slightly more money, about $36 per resident student, paid to school districts beginning in 2010 is from the permanent school fund. Representative Dryling has given you a bit of background on House File 4178 and the process that led up to that. So in the interest of time, I think I'll shorten this slide a bit. Basically, the work in House File 4178 was the result of the Governor Valenti's task force that convened in 2003 and the efforts of PS Minnesota to expand on that. There's a series of goals that House File 4178 was based on. Those goals are listed on this slide. Those include adequate funding for all public school students, a more equitable funding system, a system that has more fairness in it, a system that's somewhat more simplified, and a system that's scalable to allow a phase-in over time. Some of those characteristics of House File 4178 that meet those goals include setting the basic formula allowance at an amount high enough to cover each district's basic instructional needs. Right now, that formula allowance is set at $5,124 per pupil unit. This proposal would up that formula allowance to $7,500. In an attempt to set a basic instructional amount. Second, the state's share of special education funding in the formula is 68% of your district's personnel costs for special education, but then that amount has been capped for most of the last 15 years. This bill would remove that cap so that the state would fully fund that 68% of employees' salaries who work with special education schools. Third, in terms of the school facility needs, large school districts in the state of Minnesota are allowed to levy without voter approval for deferred maintenance fees. The same levy authority does not exist for the other 320 school districts in the state. So House File 4178 removes that size requirement and would allow all school districts to levy on board approval for deferred maintenance projects. And finally, there's some restoration of some of the equalization in the school property tax system. Equalization is just a word for the mix of state aid and local levy. A couple of the provisions of 4178 are a little highlighted for that. First of those, has to deal primarily with simplicity. We have a school funding formula that for a variety of reasons, and some of them perhaps legitimate, has a very complicated way of counting pupils.
We weight pupils by grade level. We adjust your pupil count if your enrollment is declining. We determine whether a pupil is served for residents of the district and make adjustments for those purposes as well. These adjustments all make sense in the abstract, but they make it relatively difficult to explain school finance. One of the first things that House File 4178 does is change the pupil weighting for all students to 1.0. So each full-time kid essentially counts as one pupil. That would include kindergartners, so in a sense, this would fund full-day kindergarten as well. The basic formula allowance, as I mentioned earlier, is currently set at $5,124 per pupil unit. That amount should be increased under House File 4178 to $7,500 per pupil. Second, and quite controversial from a legislative perspective, the formula allowance would be indexed to the rate of inflation as measured by the GDP implicit price inflator. There's a lot of tension in the legislature between budgeting techniques, and indexing is generally frowned on. I think there's a variety of reasons why indexing in the school finance formula may make some sense, but I suspect other committees of the legislature are going to look very negatively on anything that indexes the basic formula allowance. After the basic formula allowance, which raises most of the money for general education system, there's a second component called compensatory revenue. This raises the second largest amount of money in our school funding system, and is based on the number of free and reduced lunch students in each school district. The basis of the formula is that socioeconomic status is a proxy for students that are going to need additional assistance. And so by using the free and reduced lunch count, the formula provides additional funding to those school districts that have greater needs. Under the current formula, we have what's called a concentration formula, and the amount of free and reduced lunch money, the amount of compensatory revenue money for each district varies dramatically depending on each district's percentage of free and reduced lunch students. House File 4178 eliminates much of the concentration by granting all students from free and reduced lunch families an amount of $2,500 per pupil, or 33% of the formula allowance. This change, when you look at the printout in your packet, that's the 14-inch landscape-style printout, when you look at that printout, you're probably going to see the biggest differences among school districts based on that change in compensatory revenue. Districts with exceptional compensatory revenue will have their amounts increased on a concentration basis up to 40%. But in general, what this means is those districts with moderate amounts of students from free and reduced lunch families are going to see the largest increase in funding under House File 4178. Finally, the current calculation for compensatory revenue is based at the site level. And while I think there's a lot of good reasons for that, one of the theoretical concerns about that is the school district would have a incentive to concentrate 4 children at one site. We're not aware of any examples of that happening in Minnesota, but House File 4178 would change the formula so that it's calculated on district level data, with the money then directed to the sites and the proportions of which are. In addition to the basic formula allowance and compensatory, there's some other formula elements that are part of the general education system. One of these is called limited English proficiency revenue. This is for students, this is additional money to school districts for students who do not speak the English language as their first language. Under the current formula, limited English proficiency revenue is limited to 5 years for any one student. This bill would eliminate that restriction, and secondly, the bill would about double the amount of money in the program. It does eliminate the concentration, but it increases the amount of money for each LEP student. As I mentioned earlier, the pupil counts for districts right now have a declining revenue factor built right into them. While declining revenue is recognized as an important characteristic of the formula, this does make the counting of students quite complicated. House File 4178 moves that declining revenue from the basic formula of pupil counts into a separate categorical, and essentially would allow a school district to have as its funding either the greater of its current year pupil count or the 3-year average of its enrollment. Another one of the provisions of House File 4178 that's drawn a lot of interest and criticism is the Location Equity Index. This is essentially a funding formula that provides additional money for those school districts that are located in counties where the wage and housing data are higher than the state average. There's a rather complicated index that's used, but essentially what that index looks at is it looks at the wage rate in each county, looks at the housing values in each county, and determines the index number.
For the current calculation of that formula, which was for 2006 data, Carver County had the highest index of the state, and the only other counties that exceeded the 1.0 that have a positive index number were those in the metro area. So essentially, any school district that's located in the seven-county metro area under the current data would qualify for the location in equity index revenue. The revenue is based on the index number and the formula allowance. Essentially, if you had an index number like Carver County of 1.12 or 12%, you get half of that amount times the formula allowance, so an additional 6% of revenue under the location equity index. Statewide total about $180 million a year, depending on how it's measured. Sparsity revenue is the alternative to large district revenue in some ways. Minnesota's formula currently has a sparsity component. It goes to those school districts that are both small and geographically isolated. Currently, there's about 80 school districts out of the 340 that qualify for sparsity revenue. The revenue varies as the district gets more sparse. The sparser the district is, the greater the revenue. Under the elementary part of that formula, currently the district's sparsity revenue is only available to it if the district is at least 19 miles away from the next nearest school building. This lowers that 19-mile requirement to 15 miles. As Representative Bryan mentioned, there are some set-asides in the bill, including a set-aside for innovation revenue. Essentially, out of that $7,500, 1.5% of that has to be reserved and used to fund best practices to improve student academic performance. If a school district's not meeting AYP, or adequate yearly progress, under the Department of Education's definition and under the No Child Left Behind provision, then the school district will have to work with the Department of Education to have a plan approved by them in order to use the innovation revenue. Other reserves include 1% reserve of the general ed basic formula money for gifted and talented programs. That would be $75 per pupil that each district would need to reserve for those programs. In addition to the current relatively small levy for career and technical programs, which used to be called secondary vocational programs, an additional 0.5% or $37 for people would be set aside for career and tech programs. And then finally, the existing reserves for things like operating capital, staff development, and the basic skills program would remain. There are a number of provisions of the general education formula that are removed. Those are listed on this slide: training experience revenue, equity revenue, transition revenue, a pension offset is actually a reduction to the school funding formula. The current gifted and talented formula, which is $12 for people, are removed. And then finally, the TUCOM revenue would be removed under House File 4178. The program would be remain in existence, but the revenue source of $260 per people would be removed. Next, the referendum revenue would be offset. This is a measure that essentially tries to ensure that the referendums are used only for extra purposes. So in addition to the $7,500 of basic revenue that each school district gets, another $500 on top of that is added to each district's formula and taken away from the referendum if they have it. So a school district with a large referendum, say $1,500 per pupil, would lose $500 of that levy authority and gain $500 on the formula, whereas a school district with no referendum would pick up the $500 on the formula and not have any offset. In addition to the general education changes, which are about $1.7 billion in total if the plan were fully phased in, there are changes to three other categories of revenue. The first of these is special education revenue. As I mentioned, the current formula statewide caps the amount that goes to any school districts, so the 68% is essentially driven down to a lower number. That cap would be removed, and this would cost about $100 million a year. Next, on transportation needs, in 1995, the legislature eliminated categorical funding for pupil transportation purposes. House File 4178 would create two new transportation formulas. Essentially, 20% of each district's to and from school transportation costs would be eligible for hazardous transportation services. The hazardous plan would be developed by the district and adopted by the school board. And secondly, each district, whether they contract for buses or have their own fleets, would get an additional 5% of their total transportation costs each year that would have to be set aside for bus purchases or for paying the contractor to keep the fleets current. Finally, in terms of school facility needs, as I mentioned earlier, each large school district in the state currently can levy for their deferred maintenance needs. House File 4178 would broaden that authority so every school district on board approval could levy for deferred maintenance. Second, there's a program called the Debt Service Equalization Aid Program that helps relatively low property values of school districts build school buildings once the bonds are sold to state, commits a portion of state aid each year depending on the school district's tax base. The equalization in this, that is, the state commitment has diminished over the last 15 years. House File 4178 would increase the state participation in the Debt Service Aid Program. And second, for those school districts that have large amounts of agricultural property, a 66% credit of all of the school building bond tax that fell on farmland would be paid by the state through the ag credit. There's some other changes to property tax, primarily because of the elimination of some of the levies and the enhanced equalization. In total, about $600 million of gross property tax reduction is contained in House File 4178. But with the deferred maintenance levy, we're expecting districts to levy back about $200 million of that to the deferred maintenance levy. So the bill would end up having a net property tax reduction of about $400 million per year. The next slide just shows some of the components, how much in each of those general education components is the increase. You can look at that at your convenience. And finally, there's a list of a variety of online resources that may help you for your understanding of school finance issues. Those include links to the House File 4178 bill summary on the House website, as well as a description of the school finance system that I put together, about a 100-page guide that describes each of the formulas in great detail. And then a series of spreadsheets are linked to that show you how school funding works and how those would change with different characteristics at all. So with that, Madam Chair, that's a quick description of House File 4178.
Thank you, Mr. Strom from House Research. You can see that his competence is just beyond some of our ability to comprehend sometimes. He is amazing. I am so delighted that we have so many people who have wanted to speak this evening. I am a little bit remiss on the introductions. Yeah, there is one person that is very important who I would like to introduce, and that is my principal, who is actually sitting in the back row. That is Mrs. Linda Pond, and she was very gracious about letting us have this meeting here at Sunday School this evening. We are 1 hour away from when the meeting needs to close, and I'm going to remind those who are wanting to testify that you only have 3 minutes in which to be at the lectern. So I'm going to call on individuals, and many of you I do not know, so please forgive me if you are not getting called on right away. It's just I'm calling on you at random. I also would like to just remind you that we will be ending promptly at 8:30. And so keep your remarks succinct, and we are looking forward to this conversation. Oh, we have another representative. Representative Denny McNamara, and he also represents a portion of School District 833 where we are. I think he has more southern portion of it, but thank you, Denny, for coming with me. Good to see you. All right, at this time I would like to invite Superintendent Tom Nelson to come to the lectern for you.
After Superintendent Nelson speaks, I would like to have Karen Stealing McInnes to be ready to speak immediately so we can be very efficient on our time. Thank you.
Representative Swales and committee members, I want to welcome you from South Washington County School District. I guess what goes around comes around when people come to a board meeting. I say you have 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and I've written some remarks that I know are over that, so I will do some editing as I move through my comments. First of all, I'd like to thank you for taking on school finance. School finance is in dire need of an overhaul in in our state, and I want to thank you for taking it on. I know it won't be easy. There's a lot of things that have been built into past formulas that people won't want to give away, but I think the Minnesota Miracle would have never happened if the legislature and Governor Anderson wouldn't have held tough, and I hope that as you go forward, you do as well. I'd like to make my comments around 3 points tonight that I think you've addressed in the bill, but there's not things that are new to you, but there's something that I feel I need to say, and the first is adequacy. And this continues to be a major issue in funding of schools in Minnesota. General ed formulas have not kept pace with the cost of inflation over the years. Some years we've made it, and in many years we haven't. And the end result of all this is a over reliance on the referendum and the property tax. School districts today are using the referendum not to support the experts. They're using it to support their basic program. Our district would not survive without our reliance on referendum funding, and we're a growing district. So you can imagine where people are if they're in the declining part of the formula. Again, I applaud your efforts to deal with adequacy in this bill, and I think that if it is to pass, it would move us a long way in that direction. Second item I'd like to talk about is one of fairness. The current funding formula with its reliance on the property tax does not treat school programs or taxpayers fairly. Some communities are able, without a major effort by local taxpayers, to pass additional needed funds through a local referendum. Another community, sometimes next door, cannot pass a referendum, so the students in that district go without or pay higher fees or other types of things. This relates to programs, but it is also about your property taxpayers. And I did pass out, or I have a sheet there that I don't know if you can get or you can take with you later. It basically looks at a couple school districts, and one is the Wayzata School District, and I apologize to them for picking them out tonight, and our own school district, the South Washington County School District. Currently, today, Wayzata has a referendum of $1,476 a pupil unit, and that's a $402 burden on a $250,000 home. South Washington County, we have $927 out on the referendum, and we pay $497 on the same home. If our referendum, which I would love to have, were the same as Wayzata's, our taxpayer would pay a little over $800 on their home for the same referendum funding for Wayzata has. Reliance on the property tax produces winners and losers. And you all know that there's a few districts in the state that have no referendum. And I think that's unconscionable for those districts and the students in those districts. And it would be my hope that as you proceed with this, that you weigh property tax fairness along with funding. Finally, I'd like to just comment and credit you on your recognition of special education and ELL funding that apparently you have addressed in this bill. So our funding formulas in these areas need to reflect actual costs of educating our special needs students. It's a poor system that requires districts to divert funding from other sources to take away funding from other programs and sources to fund these mandated programs. And once again, I commend you for making the effort to deal with that. Again, I know firsthand that you have a very difficult task ahead of you, but I commend you for taking it on. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Malcolm, I gave you an extra minute because you're my boss. I'd like to call in Karen McGinnis, please.
After three years of technology,
I would like to call on Lynette Lane to be ready to speak next.
Okay, I will be brief, and I don't have any big speech prepared like Mr. Nelson. I just wrote it. I am a special education teacher, so I would like to give you a little bit of a teacher's perspective. But I tell you, I'm used to teaching and speaking to 4 and 5 students at a time, not a whole group. I teach students that are multiply handicapped, medically fragile, and severely autistic at the elementary level. And of course, I'm so glad too that you addressed the special ed need, because like most of them, I'm going to talk about special ed. I think I don't need to reiterate that stable funding is just logical, and districts should be able to know their budgets from year to year. But when I asked the teachers in my building, their biggest concern was lowering class size. And the other one was more time to prepare. Now, I'm a special education teacher, and I pretty much work year-round. And my biggest concern, personally, for my students in my classroom, is high class size for special ed teachers, and then indirectly high class size for the classroom teachers, so it impacts my students' time in the regular classroom. And then our atmosphere of constant assessments, well, it finally happened after 22 years. It happened, my students were asked not to participate in a class, and needless to say, we were a little bit disappointed because they were worried about what was going to be all the assessments and all the testing. So that's some of the things that are really nice, that aren't really good to see, that finally we're not welcoming our students with special needs into the classroom. Other things I was told by my director is we're not offering a catalog. I don't know what all this car stuff is. We're not offering a Cadillac, we're offering the watered-down Ford. So we're stooping to half days for our DCD students in kindergarten instead of full days like we've always done. We've even dropping the children with autism also are only half days. We're cutting DAIT in our kindergarten classes, which is where they need it the most, is the muscle tone, endurance, and the exercise. I don't need to tell you about the MTOS. I could talk an hour about the MTOS. I was on an MDE review committee. And there's no reason that our multiply handicapped, medically fragile, severely handicapped kids should be doing grade level assessments and grade level ones and spend that much money, $4 to $5 million. We told MDE and Pearson it wasn't appropriate, and they went ahead and did it anyway. My other concern, and I have to applaud the Minnesota State High School, is we are the only state in the nation that provides after-school programming and after-school sports for children in the nation. Only Georgia and Illinois do some partial ones. But Minnesota stepped to the plate in doing that, but that's about our only after-school program for children with disabilities and for after-school rescue for middle school and high school. I forgot to say, I'm from Hastings, and I teach in Lakeville. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That was very helpful. Now we'll be hearing from Lynette Wayne. She is a first grade teacher from Hastings School. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm so grateful that you're here to hear how our time is going in our schools and what we need. I apologize that I look a little tired tonight. I am a full-time first grade teacher and we are in the first month of school. I'm concerned about how the level of funding has not kept up with our school needs, and I can tell you that my colleagues and I are struggling with higher class sizes, more challenging students with special needs, and less resources in our classrooms. We are continually being asked to do more with less. Now, Hastings is a fairly conservative district. We do not have a high number of administrators or specialists. We do not have curriculum coaches or reading specialists like many of our neighboring districts do. And many of our class sizes, especially in the upper elementary, have grown to 29 students this year. At the secondary level, some of the numbers go even higher. We have had elementary children for the first time last year going door to door selling cookie dough so that we could upgrade our technology needs in our school. We have cut so much in the past that it has been difficult. And now we're looking at decisions like, do we cut part of our music program or our foreign language classes? Do we repair our roof or our windows? School district after school district are continuing to try to pass operating levies. And none of the communities want to ask people for more money, but we have no choice. And many of our families are struggling with these economic times, so it becomes even more difficult. In Hastings, we have an operating levy that brings over $5 million a year in, and we still have large class sizes even with that. If our levies are not renewed 2 years from now, we will need to cut $5 million in our budget, and I truly don't know where that's going to come from.
We've closed one elementary school, and we're looking at closing another. And we're doing this to save operational costs. We can eliminate administrative positions, secretarial, and custodial costs. Of course, that means all the students are going to come to our other schools, where our class sizes are going to get larger, and we won't have the space. I truly want to thank you for the $51 that you added to the formula last year. It was much needed money, and we appreciate that. And now I'm hoping, and I'm really hopeful, that long-term sustainable reform is going to be on its way. So I thank you again for being here and listening to our concerns, and please come and visit our school.
I was remiss. I needed to have somebody in the open here. So, Ms. Chapman, would you be willing to come on? And in the bulletin, I would like to Colleen Pelle.
Thank you. It's nice to have such short people here. I don't have to adjust the microphone. Thank you very much for having these hearings. Let me start by thanking you, Mr. Superintendent, for everything that you did do. Until about 3 years ago, I had no idea how thankless being a public service could be. And I am convinced, if I was a conspirator, that somebody has taken all the N keys from computer keyboards that prevents people from writing and saying nice job. So thank you, nice job for everything that you're doing. In the next few months, our school district, which is ISD 197, representing Mendota Heights, West St. Paul, Mendota, Lilydale, Funfish Lake, and parts of Eden and Invergrove Heights, for those who are not familiar, we're going to be looking at $1.5 to $2 million in cuts. This is on top of $1.6 million in cuts that we made 2 years ago, which is about $782 per student, or 15% of what the state allots us for people. We may be a small district, about 4,600 compared to other districts, but we are diverse, which puts a strain on our dollars. 65% of our students are white. 8% of our students are LEP. 14% have special needs, and 33% receive free and reduced lunch. And because we are a Title I district, we face consequences this year for not passing A1P. When I ran for school board, it was because I wanted to ensure that every student in our district was given the opportunity to reach their full potential. But thanks to the current structure of legislative funding, it has become an absolutely impossible task, despite being well-intentioned. We have encountered barrier after barrier, barriers that prevent us from reaching those who are most desperate in need for additional help, to barriers that force us to reduce opportunities for those who want to achieve individual excellence. Imagine the barriers that we're going to face again next year when we have to take another $4 million away from our general revenue to cover the gap for special education needs. Imagine the barriers that we're going to face next year because of rising fuel costs. People want us to get our children up to speed. Well, guess what? The dollars that we could use in the classroom are going to be paying for buses so that people can get to and from school, including private students, which we are mandated to transport, who often choose to go to schools well outside our boundaries. The solution of asking communities to provide voluntary support simply is not working anymore. By failing to align funding for education with inflation and by failing to fund mandated services, the legislator has obligated districts to rely on the goodwill of communities. In theory and practice, the odds are simply stacked against us. People are financially terrified, especially our seniors. And can you blame them for being cautious and not wanting to vote for a tax increase in tax? Those with children in private schools are making difficult decisions. By paying money for the private schools, they're concerned about paying more for property taxes, which creates a catch-22 for us, because without that funding, we can't show them that we don't have failing schools. We have parents that would love to vote yes for a levy in our district, because their children are learning far what they ever thought they could learn if only they were eligible to vote. They're not citizens yet. We have an economic crisis that's going on. We have become a society that is becoming more self-serving and self-centered. To go out and ask people for funds simply is not working. We are confronted by messages of politicians at the same time who are patting themselves on the back because the state is now 19th in tax rankings,
but choosing not to mention that we have dropped to 41st in ranking for total public education spending as a percent of personal income. Education, educating our youth is not something that can be discretionary. That is your mandate. And I'm telling you from the front line that the system is broken. And to do nothing short of dramatic is going to be this state's new doing. Al Quie, who I never thought I would quote, in his remarks last week at the Humphrey Institute, alluded to his own acknowledgement when he realized it was time to divorce himself from politics and focus on the good of the state. Horace Mann, who founded public education, said, "Let us not be content to wait and see what will happen, but give us the determination to make the right things happen." And then there are the words of my idealist, John Luke Picard, a star trek, who said, "Make it so." So I ask you to please make it so.
Who's on deck? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Soleil, and I am a parent, resident, teacher, and alumni from the Centennial School District in Circle Pines, Minnesota. Centennial School District, for those of you that don't know, serves students from Blaine, Lexington, Lionel Lake, Centerville, and Circle Pines. Thank you for listening to me this evening. I'm running the Centennial Learning Community. I was born and raised in the Centennial School District way back in the 60s. My daughter is a recent Centennial graduate of 2008, and I'm in my 17th year of teaching in the Centennial School District. I can speak from the resident, parent, alumni, and educator perspective on the inequity of funding for public schools in Minnesota. As a resident and taxpayer of the Centennial School District, I know exactly the frustration and heartache of increased property taxes due to levies to keep the funding going in our district and avoid astronomical budget cuts. Our community does not have the commercial business property tax base that other districts do in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, the burden of the property tax increases continues to keep our schools going has been put on the property homeowner. Centennial continues to be at the bottom of the funding per pupil year after year, and we are a peanut poor district that continues to do more with less. That's a quote from our superintendent. As a parent, the impact of the budget cuts was huge for my daughter. She sat in a classroom 3 years ago, an algebra ninth grade classroom with 49 students, and she just couldn't get it. Her dad and I spent thousands tutoring, trying to get her up to snuff, so they say, and to prevent her from failing. She was just frustrated. As a classroom teacher in the Centennial School District, the budget cuts that our district has endured year after year, over and over due to the existing funding formula, is also heartfelt. I teach in the Centennial Elementary Gifted Services Program, and my teaching position and programs have been tailored down and cut year after year. All students are being left behind because of continuous budget cuts and failed levies. The bottom line for educators is this, and that the Minnesota school finance system is broken, and I'm sure you already know that, and thank you for your hard work. Minnesota public schools, we should not have to depend on levies and bake sales to fund our school. Nor, I don't see doctors holding garage sales to pay for their tongue depressors that they're using. Sorry for my sarcasm, but it's very heartfelt. We really need funding that is equitable, sustainable, predictable, and sufficient. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. After Deborah
McConnell
from Dora Clark,
I'd like to invite
Deborah Clark from
South Lake. Hi, my name is Debbie McConnell, and I'm a parent with children in School District 197. And I co-chaired our levy campaign last fall, and I'm still tired. Thanks to Reed, I don't have to describe District 197, which includes the seven communities, Mendota Heights and Little Park Egan. I'm not an educator. I'm an MBA in corporate America, and I think in business, you know, marketing. and the ability of strong management to be able to control the success of their business. I find public education systems to be very different from Southern America. I'm amazed at how little control public school administrators have over the operation of business. What kind of system do you have that when you cannot influence your revenue stream? In order to cover basic operating expenses, you have to launch expensive and time-exhausting levy campaigns, relying solely on parent volunteers to do so. And for what, a gamble at the polls? If you lose at the levy roulette table, as I like to call it, you can't pay your employees. And because of unions, you cannot manage the quality of your workforce. Further, unlike a business, you cannot downsize or streamline because a public school is required to accept the tired, the hungry, and the poor, which is the model of our country. Like our country, public schools accept and welcome kids from all walks of life. Wealthy, poor, non-English speaking, gifted, disabled, public schools must provide the educational service to all children of our country, so it's the mass market. Included in that mass market are the kids with special needs, who will come into a system at significantly higher cost, but yet we only get a fraction of the revenue. This contrasts non-public schools who can tailor their service to a much smaller market segment. By the way, our community actually is unique. We have 14 different school choices, mostly called parochial. If their costs increase, they increase tuition accordingly. They can and do discriminate against the tired, hungry, and poor, and mentally and physically disabled, as well as behavioral issues. They are happy to accept the healthy and paying children from a family, but point the way to the nearest public school for those that may not be as healthy. Special ed costs eat up $10 million of our total budget, and that's a quarter. Of which we receive a reimbursement for $6 million. That $4 million gap just happens to be our budget deficit that we're going to be operating expenses. And what happens after years of budget cuts is we then have to cut teachers. And because of the tenure system, we have to cut the least expensive teachers first, which means we cut more teachers to make up the deficit. So now we have perhaps up to 46 students per class. How does this affect the quality of your end product? It's time we stop thinking of education as a social service and start thinking of it as a business that produces our future workforce. This workforce allows our state to compete nationally and internationally and feed their economy. Education is an investment. The product of our education is a return. This results in a business metric called ROI, return on investment. The flip side is we allow our education system to fail and we get to invest more dollars in the penal system. I've heard that we project a number of prison beds for the future based on how many second graders can't read. I don't believe the ROI on our prison system is worthy of investment. Again, if we think in terms of the business metrics and ROI, the education of our future children is an investment. Thank you.
After Deborah Clark, I would like to invite, Deborah, before you speak, we're going to just take a brief pause so that we can change the tape. So if you could just wait one second. After Deborah speaks, we're done. Can I be available to speak? Otherwise, we still have a half an hour here
So if there are members at the table who would like to comment, or if there are others in the audience who would like to speak, we have time to do that. But thank you.
First of all, thank you for what you do and for bringing this forward. And thank you for the receiving and speaking, because all I can say is I agree with all you have said. I have been in public education my whole life, more as a consumer and the daughter of educators. I was raised on class size, prep time, diversity, lived in different districts, and had all the buttons probably to approve. I currently serve on the school board in South St. Paul, and I don't want to compete with my neighbors. I want all neighbors and all people in Minnesota to have an equitable, sustainable system that produces the workforce that brings us forward. I intend to be a Pollyanna. I'm from a district that, if we weren't the little engine that could, we would not currently be in the middle of all day, every day training that we pay for. I'm not even unclear how, I'm not unclear, even as a board member, I'm not sure how we pull it off. We are pursuing IB, K-12, and we are known as a community that supports education. But we are a first-string suburb, we are changing, we test every day, we have a technology letting us up for review, and we need it. We're often one of the first that go out and do things, but our community is changing. Looking around the room, we have students from your district that choose to go into our school. However, that's not what I want to say. I want to say it is time. I want to ask the question, and hopefully not negatively, where is the Senate? It has not been fun being politically active the last years, as it seems to be. We have lost our statesmanship and we fight. That is what appears to me, and as I get ready to give up, I came across this through some of my involvement in AMSD and other things. So I'm Pollyanna again. My husband thinks I'm crazy. But Pollyanna is a much happier person than what I have been in the last few years. I am hopeful. This is not a perfect thing to me in our district. This is not perfect maybe for Minnesota, but it is a start. I get nervous at what will be pulled out, what will be put in, what a final product will be. But last night, I brought to my board a recommendation that we support the Minnesota Miracle as our legislative platform. That is a big step for our board. It's easier to go and argue in some ways for IB, we need it, we're not quite there, or maybe something for English language learners, and for special ed, as also a board member in 1917, the special ed district, this big to my heart, and so and so tech. Well, that may be easier. But Pollyanna said, we need to work together. We need you to work together with the Senate, and I don't know how you're going to pull this off. But I'm hopeful, because we need this now if we are going to move into the state of the future. Our kids need it. They need basic education. I'm not sure any of us can define that. I have a very liberal definition of basic education when it comes to music, the arts, and everything. Everything can be an experience that kids should have. I had a gifted child who went through the system through IB before it was what we're trying to make it now. She got a good education, but she will tell me there were things that were lacking then because of money. She's spoken the capital sex, we've done rallies, we've done everything, and I wish you well, because to do well, all of us in this room need to be doing better with you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. After Mr. Kennedy, we will have Julie Ryan from the Native Women Voters.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Sinner. I'm a middle school science teacher at McGuire Middle School in Lakeville, and have been in the profession for 25 years. I'm a Lakeville graduate and have lived there for 35 years. Currently, Lakeville area schools are ranked 42nd out of 47 metro area districts in per pupil strength. Yet we rank 10th when it comes to student achievement. I'd say that's time for development. Due to the status of funding over the past 4 years, Lakeville schools have been forced to make $11.4 million in budget adjustments. That's our current pool. And we'll need to make another $5.3 million in budget, I'll call them cuts this time, for the 09-10 year. Our local voters have declined to give us any additional levy revenue for the past 5 years. They've renewed one levy, but they will not give us any more dollars. In Lakeville, we pride ourselves in providing a first-class education for every student. Because of our stellar reputation in providing quality programming and services to special needs students, many families moving to the Twin Cities or anywhere in the South Metro District choose our district for their children. With the gaps that exist between state and federal mandates and existing funding streams, we are actually penalized for our excellence. I applaud you for addressing that issue in this bill. At one of our elementary schools, due to cuts in budget supplies and freezes, each teacher is provided with two reams of copy paper per month. For class sizes of 28 in grades 2 and 3 and 32 in grades 4 and 5, the teacher runs out or wants color copies. They dig into their own pocket as the students do without. This doesn't encourage best practices when it comes to authentic assessments and authentic assignments. At Century Middle School, in order to help facilitate technology integration and state testing, staff and parents worked together in the garage sale of the century to raise $38,000 to purchase a new student computer lab. I don't believe this is what is the intended consequence of the phrase free and appropriate public education in the Minnesota Constitution. At the middle level, which I've been involved with for 25 years, Lakeville has an experiential philosophy with a team teaching model. The middle level is about students finding themselves, finding their interest and their strengths. Some of our exploratory classes over the past years have been forced to pair and share students every other day, while others have been shortened, other classes have been shortened from 9 weeks to 7 weeks in order to still provide the opportunity. Because if a student isn't exposed, they don't know whether they're good at something. These include band, choir, fire, industrial tech, computer tech, facts, and art. And as budget pressures increase, any class that does not have mandatory state testing or mandatory state standards is at risk. This is a dangerous narrowing of curriculum and not in keeping with best practices for fine and applied arts. I applaud your efforts with this proposal, simply put, best practice costs money. You can't get any student achievement with a C in your budget. Using another analogy, and I hear you use the Chevy analogy, you can't drive a Cadillac while you pay for a Geo. Whatever the final solution the legislature finds to education funding, it needs to be equitable, sufficient, sustainable, and predictable. Lakeville is a perfect example of a district that is at the breaking point. It is a system of excellence that has been years in the making and is about to be forced to go back into mediocrity. Finally, phasing in the miracle may not be in time to save many districts. It may take the bravery to raise state revenues to implement, because once this mandate, programs may not be recoverable. With an inflation rate of 5.4% over the past 12 months, we're all at risk. We need predictable increases just to be able to keep pace with what we have. And I'm reminded as we're standing here in the Al Queen quote that the previous speakers used, drove home to me. I simply watched Monday Night Football and I seen the gentleman go up and we come from the Ohio State University. I'm a Gopher graduate. We are Minnesota. And we should keep that pride here. We're about to lose it. I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Lyon, I would like to invite Superintendent Jay Allen to come. You are our last official. My name is Julia Lyon. I'm Secretary of the Board of the Woodbury Cottage Grove League of Women Voters. And I'm here simply to state our position regarding this piece of legislation. The League of Women Voters of Woodbury Cottage Grove believes all Minnesota children should have equal access to a good public education. State funding for education should be at a level that makes programs of comparable substance and quality available to all. A student's access to a good education should not depend on the wealth of his or her school district. and that's the Minnesota League's position as well. And while I'm under my 3 minutes, I would like to remind all of you and invite you to attend the various League of Women Voters sponsored forums, candidate forums that will be held throughout the state and the area. Here in Woodbury and Cottage Grove, there will be 3 in October. So you are most welcome not only as candidates, but also as people who can ask questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the privilege of being last. I came to this state as an educator 20 years ago. I was a North Dakota farm boy and was a science teacher and had the opportunity to move my family someplace. My wife said yes, so I took this. And we looked for jobs and had offers in quite a number of states across the country. We looked at states and their commitment to education, because we were just starting a family, too. We wanted to raise a family. And I wanted to work in a state where I got a lot of support as a school administrator. At that time, I remember the numbers. Minnesota was somewhere like 5th in overall education funding. There's many different ways to look at those numbers, but I think today maybe the best way to say that is we're average. We've kind of, in my 20 years, kind of watched the slides and point where we're average. And it really doesn't fit very well with my dream, because I've had this dream and I've had this passion and this fire since I came to this state, that someplace should, for the first time, show that through education, every student can find success. Truly, that we can break the cycle of underachievement and poverty one time forever, because when it's broken one time, I think it's broken for good. To take a look at my school district and how we're able to do that, I want to give you a little picture. I've given this presentation to 50 people in my communities. 50 presentations in my communities to different people. I'm not mentioning the levies. I'm in my 3rd year superintendent. I got to say, my first 2 years, all I did was 9 levies. And now I'm into finally really talking about education. And I want people to know where the money goes. Because we keep saying, you know, it's not enough, and people need to know, well, what does that mean? Why is it enough? Where does it go? So we took every one of our schools and our 8 school buildings that you heard so much about from Reem and Debbie earlier, and we put them on a chart and put the amount of money we're able to spend in each school. And when you take a look at the money we can spend in each school, an elementary school, $3 million, it sounds like a lot. And it is a lot. But then when we cut the school in half and say, here are fixed costs, heating, busing, cleaning, things that we do a very thrifty job of. And then we take a look at a lot of the mandates that are good mandates. My favorite programs, special education, basic skills, English as a second language. We take a look at all of that funding, $1.6 million is spent. And so when I have to staff that school with what the public thinks of when they think of education, classroom teacher teaching kids in an office, that's $1.4 million. $1.4 million in elementary is enough to hire a principal and a secretary and one way overworked paraprofessional who does everything throughout the school day. And then enough staff so that we can have right now 25-1 in our K-4, 30-1, 5-8, and 32-1 in our high school. And 32-1 in our high school, you don't get 32 in the schedule in every class. That means your class is a 40. You put 40 large bodies in any classroom, and what is going on? Next year, we're looking to cut $2 million. And the $2 million will not come from the $1.6 million or the $3.2 million. For those schools, it'll come from the 45% in the top. So that cuts is really, really double. And the point I really want to make is that this is not something that then is done because of something we've done wrong, or money that we spent in ways we shouldn't have, that or that we have something, we're losing students. We actually gained students this year. We've done some really bold things. We've started a magnet school that increased in elementary enrollment in one of our schools from 250 to 400. We made some tough choices this year, completely retooled all of our schools and the start times and tried to make it more friendly to education and to our transportation system to save some dollars, and those are hard decisions. We have supporters of our Lebens who have changed the world so much that they're going to start their kids an hour and a half earlier, an hour later. That's, you know, part of what they said is we're not going to support you in upcoming Lebens. That's really hard to make a good choice for your school district when people are saying, you know, for us, you know, good luck coming to us for money, please. So there's just a lot of things about the system and about levies and about the money that is making it that it is very difficult to reach my dream. We're still going to keep fighting for that, but I'm here right behind you to help you fight for my dream and fight for the dream of a Minnesota education and all that that means. And all it means for prosperity, you know, and the welfare of the state. So, thank you for being here, and happy to be making it important.
Thank you so much. Are there others who would like to speak? I'd like to introduce Mary Ciccone.
Good evening. I'm sorry that I did not sign up to testify. My name is Mary Ciccone, and I'm a parent united for public schools. And I have been following this particular process and these hearings around the state. And I'm just in awe of those of you who testify, because it is just so powerful. And I often hear the response when I leave, yeah, but we were speaking to the choir. But here's the deal, guys. That's okay, because the choir really needs the same sheet music. So I think that's really important. But I'm going to ask something different. I thank this committee for doing what they're doing. This is a huge undertaking. But for us to really make a difference, we need to take this testimony to the street. We need to talk to our neighbors. We need to talk to our friends. We need to take the courageous statement that we the women leaders took. We need to make that happen, because these folks may be elected and may be in great positions to make these kind of changes, but they need our backing to make it happen. So please, consider that you humble me when you speak, but we need hundreds of thousands of people to hear the same message. So consider writing your letters to the editor, getting out and speaking to your neighbors. And you know, this is a tough one. Over the Thanksgiving turkey, actually taking this on with friends and family. So thank you, and all of you, thank you for testifying.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience?
Hi, my name is Erin Zoltukin Ridgeway, and I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, and my son is a second grader. I am obviously a parent. I volunteer with ARC, and I am a new co-chair of the St. Paul Public Schools SEEK. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk with you, and thank you for working on this. As I said, I'm a parent. I'm a parent of a child who receives special education services. My son is bright, charming, funny. He learns differently, and due to challenges with communication and executive functioning, he sometimes behaves a little differently. When he's met with kindness, understanding, flexible, and open mind, he is capable of greatness. As you know, until 1975, children who are labeled as disabled were not guaranteed an education. Children in this label sometimes were educated, sometimes were hidden away, sometimes were subjected to horrible treatment. Great human potential was wasted. We do a much better job now thanks to IDEA, but as you know, it has never been fully funded by the federal government. So the so-called burden of allowing a fair and appropriate education is passed on to the state, and if it was not fully funded there, to the local level, which causes property taxes to rise. It also causes schools to take funds from general ed to cover special ed. And then families where kids are in special education are seen as expensive burdens. I feel we should not have funds that are for special ed and general ed, but funds that are there to fund the educational needs of all kids. My son is not disabled. He learns differently. The educational funding system, however, is disabled. Let's work together to make sure it meets the needs of all kids.
I'm Carrie Myron from Timber Grove Heights. Please bear with me. I wasn't planning on doing this, so I'd like little bullet points here. Education funding in Minnesota has achieved exactly what it set out not to. Education is based on your zip code. $6.5 million is what we set out of our budget in the last 7 years. Our budget's only $33 million as it is. That's plain summer budget. We cut $1.2 million last year. And evidently, we probably did it too well. We did it without touching the majority of the students. So then, when we went out and ran an operating levy, we went down in a ball of flames. Y'all probably thought. If we pass a renewal, a straight renewal this fall, we will cut 1.2 out of the budget for next year. If it fails, we'll be cutting close to $3 million, 10% of our budget. We were named one of the best performing high schools in the state of, or in the country by Newsweek magazine. That's really cool. Everything is on the table if you're cutting 3%, $3 million out of your budget. It's not mandated. It's on the table. We're not talking extra. We are talking basic education. Is our bond or is our levy going to pass? Here's what we're facing. 83% of our residents in our district do not have students in our schools. 17%. Even if those 17% all voted yes, what do you think the chances are that our levy is going to pass in a national election? I'm on the finance committee. I'm telling administrators that I need to see budget cuts of $3 million. I'm also the parent of 3 students in our district. I have a first grader with 28 kids in class. I have a fifth grader with 32. That's the reality. And honestly, they're good kids. For the most part, these teachers do a fantastic job with what they have. But do you want to stick 5 to 10 more kids in each of their classrooms? And then expect them to make adequate yearly progress? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, please. You drove the farthest. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Steve Jordahl, and I probably did drive the furthest, but I looked at my options. As superintendent of schools, I felt I needed to get to one of these, and I looked at Peter and Paul, the Midgey, Overfame, Rochester, here. I'll take the 6 minutes for this one for you. First of all, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and the rest of you for putting this on. Mindy, here to talk at public radio. We really appreciate your efforts in this, and I would love if we could get you out to the St. Cloud and talk about these same things. Since 2002, St. Cloud schools have really changed. We have become a lot more diverse. We've become more needy with our special needs kids. And we've also at the same time cut $20 million in those years. $20 million from what would have been at one time over $100 million, and now it's about a $90 million budget. This year we If we don't pass this levy referendum, we will be one of those schools in the state of Minnesota without a levy referendum. We currently have a levy referendum of $97 in the books. It's almost embarrassing to admit that. That will go away, and we are going after a levy referendum that would really help us out. We have some concerns in our district because we are a regional site with quite a hospital, quite the services for a lot of families that are attracted to the St. Cloud area, therefore our special needs population is high. We have over 1,000 kids that are ELL. That's over 10% of our population. We have 300 and some kids this year that are in ELL because they're new to the country. We have 42 languages being spoken in our district. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, diversity meant a Lutheran moving to So times have really changed. We're really proud of our diversity, by the way, so don't think that we aren't, but it takes so much more to get the job done. We know that we have to go after these levy referendums in this tough time with the economy the way it is, and we are out like crazy selling this. And it's like Jay said, I didn't realize in my 4 years of being a superintendent now that I would be so wrapped around trying to get levy referendums passed. This is my 25th year in education, and I've never seen a time when we're going to struggle more. If we don't pass this, St. Cloud schools are going to cut $4.5 million more. And it's not a threat, it's the reality of what we have to do. We will cut 55 teachers. We know that our budget is mostly people, obviously, just like everybody else's. 55 teachers in a school district of about 800 teachers. That's just, the impact of that will be incredible. We will close an elementary school, which means that we will have to redraw boundary lines everywhere across that district. We will cut special ed by $500. I don't know how you do that when there's so much that's held harmless. We will make sure that we cut all junior high activities. And believe me, I am a huge supporter of activities. We know that we'll cut 2.5 administrators, and we are already the lowest among school districts our size in administrative costs. We will make sure that we put programs together where they don't necessarily belong just to make ends meet. I'm thinking about what this line said from the League of Women Voters. I felt like you were quoting the Constitution. All right? Which was. You were pretty much right from the Constitution. I want to know where if freedom of speech means I got to go out and pass a levy to talk here. And it just doesn't make sense if that's what we have to do. Thanks.
You know, we only have 5 minutes left, and I think it would be wonderful if some of the legislators here had an opportunity to ask questions or respond. I believe Senator Sutton.
Thank you very much.
It's wonderful.
I'm guessing that School District 197 is having a crisis because you're all here tonight. And, you know, a couple years ago, it was people from my district in Stillwater or people from Brainerd. And so it's like we all need to listen to each other because maybe some districts are getting by this year and so this isn't a crisis, but it is for you. And I think that's where we all need to stand together on this, and it's why I called for a hearing last November after parents had to feel like they were in combat with their ministry trying to pass their operating levies. And in many districts, when not, it didn't even require additional tax effort, they barely produced by, and that was really scary. So somebody asked, where's the Senate? Well, I'm at the table tonight, and I want you to know that the Senate is looking very thoughtfully at this proposal, and over the summer, we've all been working very hard. I've been working on early intervention and STEM areas initiatives. Terry Bonoff has been working very hard on early childhood and early intervention, because if we can catch kids earlier, we can save money, which is an important thing. And Sandy Rummel has been working on our testing areas and those kind of things. So, you know, we all need to stand together going into this session. We need to look at the budget forecast. We need to see what we can do together. So let's be thoughtful and listen to the dialogue and all be part of it.
because I think that's how we work it up together. So I really want to thank everyone for being here. And remember that we are state legislators. We represent all children in the state. So while our district may not have a crisis in one area, we need to listen to all of you. Are there other members who want to speak?
I'd like perhaps Representative Brennan to give us some closing remarks.
Thank you very much. I would echo what Gary Ciccone said, take it to the streets because we are the choir in here, and I'm so glad that we have this being taped so that other people can watch it at home. I did have my chance on MCR today, Senator St. Cloud. So I'm not going to say a lot, but I'm hoping, you know, this is a bipartisan proposal. It was co-chaired by the Senate and the House, and so hopefully when we get into session, I hope we can hear some of the calls and the comments from the Senate that will be thoughtfully added. We did have one hearing up in Peace River because that is where the Education Finance Chair in the Senate resides. And so Senator Stump came and he was, we went to dinner afterwards. And I feel that that we do have really accepted here in the Senate. And, you know, we only got the $51 this year because the Senate and the House worked together. We could have been undone many different ways had we not been united. And that is such a lesson for all of us, to all the different types of school districts are united. If we did end runs around each other, then legislators always say, gone. You know, if you're not agreed, then there are other things that are agreed. And there are other big players at the legislature that we also support. You know, I certainly support health care as well. So we have to be united. We have to speak loudly. And we have to be speaking to candidates' meetings and everything else to get I think, the top priority for the coming year. Education has been slighted even when other things have been being funded. So I just think we need to be plumped into the budget first, and then everything else has to kind of fit in where it may, instead of being last, like we have been the last few sessions. So I just thank everybody and all the legislators who are here. I know everyone is so busy, but legislators have been coming to all these hearings because we are hearing from you. So thank you so very much.
Again, thank you for coming, and at this time, the meeting is adjourned.